Can the people who are close to the speakers in the back push, turn them on? And then buttons in the back of them.
There. Back corner. And that way maybe you'll hear. But the people who need to hear that can't hear.
Just. Okay, so let's see. That's a little bit loud. Let's see, is that, that's better? Is that just right, or is that too much, or?
Too much.
Too much? It's going to echo a little bit today. How's that? We want to do it as low as we possibly can and still for it to work, to help. Doesn't it work? A little bit more?
Distorted.
Let's see, is that better now at all? Just going to turn it down a little bit more. It's kind of echoey today, kind of tinny today. How's that? Little bit of a.
One speaker might be a little louder than the other.
Yeah, and turn one of the speakers off. Turn the one over there off. And let's see, is that, how's that now? Nothing? Is that good enough to hear me? Mm-hmm. Just. It was very heartfelt for me to come in here, and just to come here. I was so happy to come here today, and. When I first came, I had this idea there would be maybe 10 people. Because I came a little bit early, and there were about 8 people here. And I didn't think anybody else would come. And how very nice, we'll just sit in a small group in a circle. And then I was kept being surprised, but people kept coming. And we have a pretty good group today. Let's see. Let's see now. Is that... How's that now? Okay. So welcome to the new year. Happy New Year and such things. And I just came from teaching what we call the New Year's retreat down in Santa Cruz for 6 days, and we stayed up until midnight last night and had a little ritual and sat in silence into the new year. And and so it's still kind of fresh in my mind, both the loveliness of last night and the retreat ending today, and then coming down here and sitting with you all. And it seems like a very nice thing to do, to bring in a new year by sitting in silence and quiet. And I think a lot of people who are at the retreat almost preferred it, compared to some of the normal ways of celebrating New Year's. But there are many wonderful ways to celebrate New Year's. And I wanted to read first a poem. And this poem is by one of the current abbots of the Zen Center in San Francisco, Norman Fisher. And it's titled, A Model of the Universe. What we want is a model of the universe that includes everything, leaving nothing out. Yet it's completely different, fresh, unique, holding nothing in common with any of its constituent elements. Yet it's not strange, exotic, and does not make us feel uncomfortable. What we want is a model of the universe we can read about in a magazine article with pictures. Yet it can't be just another magazine article, and it can't be in a regular magazine. This magazine will glow as it shimmers before our eyes. What we want is a model of the universe that will answer all our questions, to which we can refer for all sorts of advice, to foretell the future, cure bursitis, get rich, quick, aphrodisiac, and so on. And will be absolutely foolproof 100% of the time. What we want is a model of the universe that we can talk to coyly, we can droop our eyelids at, plump our lower lips, begin to sniffle, and it will pat our shoulders and say, there, there, dear, grow sad and droopy itself, but without ever really losing its composure or assurance. What we want is a model of the universe so complex we can never understand it, so simple we can grasp it in a glance and explain it to our friends via a few simple sentences. What we want is a model of the universe which once in our possession becomes identified so strikingly with us that we become internationally famous, our names household words, the meaning of our doing and saying an eternally living legacy around which all subsequent culture is organized. What we want is a model of the universe we can count on time after time. It is never tiring, never predictable, eternally new. What we want is a model of the universe that is better than someone else's model of the universe, that makes their model of the universe look really pale by comparison. Although only we realize this, we and our intimate friends. But our model of the universe is also better than the model of the universe of even our intimate friends. Although the fact of the matter is that no one but us really possesses a model of the universe, it is our own little secret. However, we write poems about it that strike others as infinitely suggestive and profound. But since this makes us feel lonely, we want a model of the universe that everyone understands. We want a model of the universe that explains everything, yet doesn't take the mystery out of anything, in fact, adds mystery. Even to the simplest of daily actions, a model of the universe that keeps us fit and eating delicate and healthy foods, a model of the universe in which we appear never overweight nor old. Yet we don't want to actually appear in this model of the universe. We want to be beyond it, holding it in our hand, looking at it from a distance. Yet we don't want to feel alien from it either. We want to love. We want love. We want a model of the universe in which we can always stay home, yet be able to travel whenever we want to remote places where all foreign languages are actually English. Though they never lose their ethnic charm. What we want is a model of the universe contiguous with the total shape of time, so that it neither begins nor ends, is neither something nor nothing. What we want is a model of the universe in which this poem, therefore, never ends and in which it never began. So we have put huge demands on our various models of the universe that we want to try to understand it all. And what are these models that we live by? And how important are they? And, you know, wars are fought over points of view, and many of us get models of universe, and everyone has them. Everyone has a philosophy, even if they don't know it. And they're such simple things. Some people feel that the world is not a trustable place, or everybody is loving, or a personal model about yourself, that you're unworthy, or that you're the best. And you hold it in a fixed way, like a model that is supposed to serve in every possible situation and circumstance. So what are these models, and how do they affect our lives? There's a classic story that's told in the Vipassana tradition in America about, I guess it was a Vipassana student in the maybe late 60s, early 70s, who was traveling from Europe to India and was crossing some great desert. Maybe there's a desert between Iran and Afghanistan, I don't know. And it was a huge desert, and there's a small kind of narrow, maybe single lane road. They went for mile after mile after mile on this huge desert. And at a certain point in the middle of this big empty desert, there was a border crossing that had a little hut with a little policeman or immigration man inside, and had a little bar that you lifted up the road and down. And so they went there and they checked through and they lifted the bar and they drove through, and the other side of the bar, this endless expanse of empty desert again. And the person kind of, you know, looked and was kind of amazed that there was this endless, endless desert, and someone had put this bar down in the middle of it. And it had all this consequence and all this significance. And maybe it was Iran and Iraq, and maybe the same place then in the 80s they had all this war and fighting. But what is this line in the desert? you know, it's, does it exist? Do these, some of these borders that we create between countries, do they really exist? What are they? They belong, they exist in a sense, but they belong to the world of human thought, human creative thought and associated thinking. And then we take these thoughts and we project it onto the world. And then we can do things like fight wars and other creative things. And it's kind of easy maybe to see that, you know, that a border between two countries in the middle of a desert may be somewhat arbitrary. But a lot of other things that are somewhat arbitrary and kind of social creations aren't so obvious, and we take them quite for granted that they're literally true and real and absolute. And the challenge that Buddhism offers is that a common model of the universe that many of us have is that there's a self. And the challenge is that find out whether there is or not. Or is it just another border crossing in the middle of the desert that's kind of put there arbitrarily? Well, my friends, New Year's is just like this. And the secret is that New Year's doesn't exist. And this, the New Year's that we celebrate doesn't celebrate any particularly important astrological event. There's nothing particularly that's happening. We're kind of confused about our months anyway. You know, we say December is a 12th month, but the Latin word December means the 10th. You know, so then how do you know? That's kind of odd. And anyway, and you can go. It's wonderful to live in the Bay Area because there's all these different cultures and nationalities that live here, and you can go around and celebrate New Year's many times a year because they all, many cultures have different New Year's they celebrate. So what is this New Year's? And so then, you know, people stay up late and they anticipate it and they get all excited and they maybe get a little bit tipsy and they do strange things with party hats and blowers and firecrackers and, you know. And in any kind of normal situation, you would think they're a little bit odd. But it's a kind of time, it's a kind of carnival time for many people, and they can let loose and be a little bit different. And then they stand there kind of poised and waiting and silent and whatever for this monumental event to happen. And what is it? What happens? Absolutely nothing. Nothing happens at all, and then they celebrate, and, you know, and jump, you know. New Year's doesn't exist. Have you ever thought about that? And then people get depressed because they weren't invited to New Year's party. They were invited to something, they're celebrating something that doesn't exist. New Year's doesn't exist. But at the same time, well, I'll tell you a story first. There's a story of a Chinese Zen monk in ancient China who spent 20, 30, 40 years, many years, practicing intensely, seeking for his enlightenment. And he couldn't, and to his frustration, nothing happened. So finally he went in pilgrimage around China. And he went to the most sacred mountain in China and started climbing to the top. And coming down the mountain was the great Bodhisattva wisdom, Manjushri Bodhisattva. And he was coming down like an old man, carrying a big bag of luggage or his goods in a big bag over his shoulder, like a maybe, I don't know, like a traveling mendicant or... And so he saw Manjushri coming down the mountain and he said, how do I get enlightened? I've been practicing for so long. And Manjushri just dropped his bag, his baggage, all his luggage, just dropped it. And the monk understood and was enlightened. Just let go of all those lines in the middle of the desert. And then he said, because he wasn't so attached to his enlightenment, maybe, he said, what do I do now? And Manjushri picked up his luggage, put it over his shoulder, and started walking down the mountain. So I've told you now that New Year's doesn't exist, which is a very good Buddhist thing to learn, because Buddhism teaches that that all things, in a sense, are empty. Though if you don't understand the philosophy behind that, then you get depressed. But it's supposed to be really make you happy. And So all things are empty. And then it says that everything that's empty also has form. And that form is empty and emptiness is form. And that what we do in Buddhism is we understand the nature of such things, that they're part of our social creation. And we kind of, in a sense, it's not popular to use this word anymore, but we kind of deconstruct them and see through the semblance of permanence and absoluteness and forgrantedness that we give them. And then we have a choice of what to do next. And one of the choices we have is to pick it up again. And one of the choices at this non-event of New Year's is we can pick it up again. And maybe treat it in a different way, make it our own. And that's what we did last night at the retreat. And celebrations like that, or festivities where we come together, I think are very important for us as a culture, as a people. Rituals of creating sangha, of togetherness. Rituals of affirming or empowering our basic intentions or commitments or qualities that we have. So we don't have to kind of get rid of this thing that our society has kind of handed us, or think that it's just an albatross around our neck or whatever. But we can pick it up again and use it for ways that really help us in our life. So it's kind of funny it doesn't exist. But also it's quite wonderful, and it's almost becomes a sacred event. And it's wonderful that for Buddhists it's really wonderful that something that's nothing becomes sacred. Because, you know, maybe that's what there is anyway. And so one of the things that, and it's nice to have a sangha, it's nice, I think, to start a new year, to end one year in the context of one's practice, spiritual practice and spiritual community. And it's nice to begin a new year in the context of one. So many of you came here today on the first day of the year. And it's kind of like, maybe for some people, it kind of brackets the year with your spiritual values or your spiritual intention or your heartfelt intention, what you want for yourself. And so there's a tradition in the West of making resolves on New Year's Eve. And I think it's a beautiful thing to make resolves. Because resolves can be many things. But resolve can also be an expression of some of the deepest things that the heart wants. Not necessarily what your surface mind wants, you know, another Lexus. But, you know, what your really heart wants. And the heart doesn't want more Lexus. The heart wants, what does it want? What does your heart want right now? And to know that it's okay if we have a heart with a desire, for a wish. Maybe it wants to be released, to be freed from all the arbitrary lines in the middle of the desert that you live your life by. Or maybe it wants to express its love, or to find its love. Or maybe your heart doesn't want to be a stranger from yourself anymore. There's many things that the heart wants, and you can resolve to have those. Or you can resolve to live in a way that supports that possibility of open-heartedness and compassion and peacefulness in your heart and your mind. So we people make resolves. And the joke in America is it lasts about 2 days. Well, so you do it again. And you don't beat yourself up, but you just... Resolve is a beautiful thing. It's not something to measure yourself by, but it's something almost to inspire yourself by. And maybe you can't live up to it, but you can. At least you were inspired for a moment. And then you inspire yourself again by something that comes out of your heart, out of the deep wellsprings of your life. And I love the word resolve, because resolve comes kind of from the word solve. The Latin root of the word means to untie or to free up, to free. And, you know, so we have solvent and solution. And to free up, to untie. I think that, I think, is one of the movements of the heart, is to untie itself. And enlightenment in Buddhism is called sometimes the sure heart's relief, release. The sure heart's release. And so that's a lot different. That's a lot different from striving. And one of the great hindrances in any spiritual life, especially Buddhist life, is to strive with some great struggle and ambition and for some kind of goal that's really separate from yourself. But to have resolve to untie what's naturally there, to let give it space and give it room, I think is a beautiful thing. It's one of the beautiful things that we can celebrate in ourselves. And in some schools of Buddhism, they call it bodhicitta, or the aspiration for awakening. And it's considered to be one of the most beautiful things that exists in a practitioner's mind and their heart. And it's celebrated and reinforced and cultivated in some schools of Buddhism more than almost anything else, that resolve. And the word strive, I looked up that in the dictionary, and the etymological root for strive comes from the word means struggle or quarrel. So no wonder we don't like to strive. So what is your resolve? And then I look up the word commitment. And commitment means to touch or to connect. And what I think about commitment, how I kind of understand it here, is that resolve is your heartfelt intention. And the commitment is the way we want to put that into action, or we want to act on that in a way that connects us with others or touches others around us, our society and our beings. So commitment is not an obligation or a duty. But again, it's something that inspires us as a way of following through to connect us and bring us closer to others. So we can make a resolve, for example, to speak honestly, to speak the truth. And to speak the truth is a way, I think, of bringing connection, real connection with others. Because even when you say you're angry, and it's true, that person has a chance then in return to connect to you, because you're presented yourself. If you kind of say, well, things are okay, and you're really angry, the person will miss you. And actually, you might miss yourself. And there are people I meet who are so afraid or aversive to their sorrow and their sadness. And what they don't know is that sometimes by pushing down their sorrow and their sadness, at the same time, they're pushing down their capacity for joy. So the tradition the thing that in a Buddhist community would do on a non-event like this is to express loving kindness, the resolve of loving kindness, but also to express this heartfelt desire for release and freedom and love by taking refuge and taking the precepts. And how I understand the precepts, there's many ways of understanding them. And one way of understanding the precepts is they are the definition or the natural way in which an open-hearted person would live their life. And it isn't like it's a commandment from above and someone tells you, thou shalt do this, or you have to do this, or you'll be bad. But rather, when your heart is sensitive and present, and you're present in feeling others and feeling your own heart and your own body and your own mind, and you feel what a tremendous violence it is to harm someone else. And you simply just wouldn't do it. That open-heartedness simply wouldn't harm someone else, not intentionally. And you wouldn't steal, and you wouldn't lie, and you wouldn't take advantage of others' sexuality or confuse it. And you wouldn't cloud or confuse the mind of yourself or others. So the precepts are, when we take the precepts, it isn't so much we take them, it depends, many ways of taking them, but I'm suggesting tonight that it's not so much we take them in order to take on this burden. Now I have to kind of live my life in this prison of certain ways of behaving. But rather we take them on as an inspiration that maybe these precepts are really our true nature in itself. And so it's kind of a joyous thing to take precepts in Buddhism because we understand that it's really who we are. And the precepts but the precepts are more than that in the sense that they're also kind of maybe lines in the desert. And the precepts only stand out when we cross that line. And we cross the line and we're going to notice that we're going to harm someone or steal or something. You don't have to feel necessarily guilty or bad. But what you can do is take that in that as a finger pointing back at your own heart and say, look, this is interesting, this is a cue, and maybe you've lost touch with something really essential. So the precepts are guides back to the essential, rather than, you know, whatever that it is sometimes in the Western tradition. So that's the way I understand precepts. It's kind of a delightful expression of the awakened heart, or the free heart, of our heart itself. And to take refuge for Buddhists is to take refuge in that orientation which moves us in the direction of that open heart. And to decide that that's important, that for us, there's great value in reorienting our life so that our life is in harmony or moves in harmony, moves towards a life which is not in conflict with oneself and others, a life which is not rushing around so fast that there's no chance to be intimate with ourselves. I talked to a woman at this retreat. She wrote on the interview sheet when she started the retreat. Everybody fills out a little interview sheet, and she wrote on the bottom, we have a little section, do you have any current illnesses? And she wrote, I haven't been sick for 15 years, but I came to this retreat with a cold. So she just said that. And she came for her interview. And it turns out she hasn't stopped for 15 years. She's been running around, and she talked about one of the things she learned from this retreat was the way she talks about taking a shower is she's jumping into the shower. And I was just jumping into the shower, and she decided that she was going to change the word of how she takes a shower to she was going to ease herself into the shower. So to reorient our life in a new direction. And even in small ways or whatever way. So to take refuge represents this the desire or the willingness or the inspiration to change directions a little bit and live in a different way. Slow down, give ourselves time. And think time, so we're talking about time because it's New Year's. And time is such an important thing, to give ourselves time. If you don't give yourself time, you don't give yourself yourself. And if you're rushing around trying to fill all your time, you lose yourself, really. And then if you give yourself time, real time, and then inhabit your time fully, then you lose time again. But this time you lose it in a very different way, and you find the timeless. So Thomas Merton was asked once, or wrote once, about what he liked best about what happened to him when he went on retreat. And he wrote that what he liked the most was being attentive to the times of the day, when the birds began to sing, and the deer came out of the morning fog, and the sun came up. The reason why we don't take time is a feeling that we have to keep moving. This is a real sickness. We must approach the whole idea of time in a new way. We are free to love, and we must get free from all imaginary claims. We live in the fullness of time. The whole thing boils down to giving ourselves a prayer of a chance to realize that we have what we seek. We don't have to rush after it. It was there all the time. And if we give it time, it will make itself known to us. There is in all this a sense of the unfolding of mystery and time, a reverence for gradual growth. So at the retreat last night, then everybody wrote a resolve for the new year. And then they put it in the altar late in the evening. And then just before midnight, John Travis, the other teacher, and I took all the little resolves And we threw them into the fireplace, or into the wood-burning stove. And they, where did they go? We did a similar thing at a retreat in November, at the end of a 16-day retreat, and people wrote an intention. And there, at the end of the retreat, we went outside, and we built, dug a hole, and we had all the intentions were written on, most of them were written on a kind of rice paper, and we put all the intentions in this hole, and then we planted a tree on top, and so now people can go back and visit their intentions. So what are some of the intentions that you might have for this new year? It'd be nice to hear from a couple of few people. Did you make resolves, or do you have anything inspire you right now? To be shy because New Year's doesn't exist.
I've never made a practice of doing that.
Sorry?
I've never made a practice of doing that.
One of the things that I strongly recommend to people is to spend some time reflecting, discerning, feeling, sensing, allowing for what your deepest intention might be for your life. And Buddhism, in a sense, is a religion of intention. And understanding your intention is really important. And I think intention is part of life. So I encourage people, actually, it's very, very important, I think, to do that. And sometimes you can ask yourself every day, and it might change from day to day. But to find that and be inspired by it, and it's so easy to lose it. So many people came this evening. I kind of have a hard time believing that there isn't some intention. Maybe people are just embarrassed. Yeah.
Last year my intention was to get myself on the map, was the way my teacher put it. And I feel that I've made some progress with that, and I'd like to extend that intention to working on seeing whoever else is in the situation and myself as all being on the map, and trying to be more inclusive of not so much either or as both and.
Beautiful.
From the either or mentality to the both and.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And once you get on the map, you can use it to get here. Thank you. Yes.
Well, it's sort of hard to say because I feel a little funny about it, but I'm very poor this year, but I feel really rich because I realized that I had a lot of things that I didn't need and I didn't really want and that used to mean something to me. And so instead of buying presents this year, I gave things away in December. And I even did it today. I mean, I had a whole bunch of things that I cleaned up. And the more space that I make, the more I feel that I have more somehow. And I had a table, and I had a bottle collection on it, and I had a vase, and I had all the stuff. And right now, I tried the table bare, and I liked that pretty good. But now I just have one thing on the table, and it looks better to me than it's ever looked. And I just have a lot less than I did a month ago. And it's what I always intended, but for some reason it was really difficult, particularly when I gave away some things that I've had for 20 years and I realized the only reason I had them was because I had always had them.
Beautiful, thank you. Yes.
One of the things that I realized today when I was writing my journal was that two of the most important resources I have are my time and energy. And I think it was a real surprise to me because most of the time I think it seems like a career in order to justify my suffering. And so my resolution or my intentions here is to exercise much more discrimination about how to use it for things in our lives that really aren't quite needed. So just further away, I'm going to show up.
We've become a Quaker meeting. Yes.
I spent yesterday evening alone doing a little private ritual for an intention. And the reason I did is because I found myself over the last 3 months really in a tailspin of busyness. And so I chose not to spend time in company repeatedly over the holidays and instead to spend time alone to remember what my intention was, and I was really surprised how quickly I'd forgotten. So one of the things I did yesterday evening was to write. I did some art, and then I wrote a list of intentions. And my intention was to read the list. and maybe it'll only be for 2 days, but on the list were things like go slowly and do art and dance and pay attention and be gentle, and these things that are such a central part of my practice. But I'm in a new situation this year, so I'm just amazed at how quickly I forgot. So it was such a pleasure to do that, and and to maybe let go of it if I forget again.
Thank you. One of the things, if you listen to people's intention like this, there's a kind of knowing behind it. Kind of knowing of what maybe is wise to do, or knowing of some richer quality of way of being and being alive, and wanting somehow to honor that. So then we'll end with those of you who would like to join in with chanting together the refuges and the precepts. We'll do some of it in Pali. When we do the Pali, we'll do word by word. And when we do the English, we'll just do a line at a time. So you can repeat after me. Namo.
Namo.
Tassa.
Bhagavato
Bhagavato
Arahato
Sammā
Sambuddhassa
Sambuddhassa
Namo
Namo
Tassa
Tassa
Bhagavato
Bhagavato
Arahato
Arahato
Sammā Sambuddhassa
Sambuddhassa
Namo
Namo
Tassa
Tassa
Bhagavato
Bhagavato
Arahato
Arahato
Sammā
Sambuddhassa
Sambuddhassa
Buddham
Saranam
Gacchami
Dhammam
Saranam
Gacchami
Sangham
Saranam
Gacchami
I take refuge in Buddha
I take refuge in Buddha
I take refuge in Dharma
I take refuge in Dharma
I take refuge in Sangha For the sake of our training, repeat.
For the sake of our training,
I vow not to harm others.
I vow not to harm others.
For the sake of our training,
for the sake of our training,
I vow not to take what is not given.
I vow not to take what is not given.
For the sake of our training,
for the sake of our training,
I vow,
I vow
not to speak falsehoods.
Not to speak falsehoods.
For the sake of our training.
For the sake of our training.
I vow not to abuse sexuality.
I vow not to abuse sexuality.
For the sake of our training.
For the sake of our training.
I vow not to cloud my mind with intoxicants. So welcome to 1996, and I hope you have a wonderful year.
Announcements.